Communication with law enforcement and government agencies is key work for advocates of those facing behavioral health issues. Our guest on this week's In Focus is here to share with us more on the work that the National Alliance on Mental Illness has done locally. Please welcome Micah Pearson, an advocate for NAMI Donyena County. Mr. Pearson has also recently been elected to serve on NAMI's national board. Congratulations, Micah, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, I'd like to start off with talking with you about how important is it for the work that you do to be in sync with local law enforcement and government agencies?
Well, it's critical for a wide variety of different reasons. One of them is actually deeply personal. My primary reason for the work that I do with NAMI is that I am a person who lives with bipolar disorder, type 1, rapid cycling with psychotic features. And as part of my own experience in engaging with my condition and eventually my recovery, I unfortunately interfaced with law enforcement and was kept in detention and denied access to treatment for an extended period of time. And so a lot of the work that I do with our community and with the organization as a whole is to prevent that from happening to other people.
Now, when and where did this happen to you?
So my experiences were about 6 years ago, in 2010 and 2011, at Maryland, D.C., and Virginia.
Now, share with us a little bit about what your life was like before you really started to face these issues.
So before that time, I was an information technology manager at the Washington Post. I ran two of their IT departments, their commuter-based newspaper, The Express, and their Latin American publication, El Tiempo Latino. I was responsible for all of their, everything relating to their technology needs. And I'd like to think I was pretty good at my job since they kept me around. And I was happy, had a home, I had a good life. And it was, but I was struggling a lot with my condition. I was diagnosed with my condition in my early 20s, but we believe I manifested it as young as 4, with the psychotic features coming in around 15. And so I was 34 or 35 before I was fully engaged with my recovery. So that's a long time to live with a really serious condition.
You said that you were dealing with this possibly as a young person. So, I mean, what were some of the things that you can remember at those early stages of life that were happening to you?
So I was always isolated. I avoided contact with other people. And then that switch would flip. And suddenly I was running around the entire neighborhood, screaming, throwing things at people's houses, that sort of thing. My behavior was really erratic, more so than your average child, especially by the time I became 15, I was convinced my house was haunted because I constantly heard things in the house. And one moment of note was when I was in the house on a Saturday afternoon, I heard my mother calling my voice repeatedly. And I couldn't find her. I was looking for her. It turns out I was in the house and it was empty. And but I could still hear her calling my name over and over again. And that was really frightening and troubling. Unfortunately, I didn't feel comfortable telling anybody about that until I was in my mid-20s.
Now, was that when you first started to talk to somebody about this? Or?
Well, I was fortunate in the fact that I have parents who were reasonably well-educated about mental health. And so from a very early age, they were doing their best to get me access to services in some way, shape, or form. Unfortunately, I'm 40 years old, and most of the stuff we were talking about was in the late 80s, early 90s, and the science of the day didn't jibe with the idea that I could be manifesting my conditions at the age that I was.
Yeah.
So while we were telling the providers, hey, this is happening, the providers were like, it can't be happening. So, and then when I was 22, they said, oh, it's totally happening. So that was frustrating. And then I, of course, didn't get a fully accurate diagnosis until I was 35.
35 years old.
Right.
I mean, we're talking about a critical time in your life. You're having a career. You were married at the time, is that correct?
Right, yes. I've been married twice. And the I guess the gift of my second marriage was that it was a very abusive relationship. I say a gift because it was in that I actually got an accurate diagnosis. Sure, I also ended up with the co-occurring post-traumatic stress disorder. That was less of a gift, but the fact of the matter was that I wasn't engaged with psychiatric services before I got in that relationship, but I certainly am engaged with them now.
Now, can you share with us a little bit about what the experience was like that, you know, where you ended up in protective custody?
Sure.
And in detention?
Yeah, as I mentioned previously, my relationship with my second wife was deeply abusive. She beat me, she laid out a suicide kit for me one day and told me that a real man would take his own life. And finally, she stabbed me. And when she stabbed me, the police came and saw that I was 6 feet tall and she was 4 foot 11, and that I had a diagnosed mental health condition, and locked me up. Even though I repeatedly said that, hey, I was the victim here, look at the blood pool, actually demonstrated the fact that I was nowhere in a threatening position. So they kept me in custody in Virginia. I was there for 2.5 weeks. The first week I was kept in a holding cell where the lights were never turned off. The window to my cell was about yay big. And I was not in clothes. I was in a smock. We called it the turtle suit because the front of it looked like the stomach of a cartoon turtle. And I didn't have a blanket, and I had a mat. And most importantly, my uncle, who was a retired Metro PD officer for DC, came to the jail, and he told him, my nephew has a serious mental health condition. Here are his medications. Please make sure he takes them. And they did not give them to me. So I was kept from any sort of psychiatric treatment for about a week and a half to 2 weeks. Time's a little fuzzy for me here. So by the time I was actually taken into a psych unit, I was experiencing visual and auditory hallucinations, which I had not experienced since I was 15. And they finally gave me some access to treatment, but it was still another 4 or 5 days before I was given any sort of clothing. It was a difficult experience at best, but it was certainly an illuminating one, especially considering that this was in Arlington Detention Center, which is less than a mile and a half from NAMI National Headquarters. And I did not know that at the time.
So what was the experience that really led to getting you out of protective custody? How long were you in there?
Well, eventually my parents were able to acquire an attorney, and this is again one of the benefits of my experience is that I grew up in economic privilege. And so my parents could afford to pay for the private attorney since I was denied a public defender. And the attorney argued successfully that they had held on to me longer than any potential charge could carry. So let me go and sort out why I was there. Because the assault charges had been dropped due to complete lack of evidence and the fact that I was saying she stabbed me. So they got me out of detention and took a while to clear out some other things, but I was living on my grandmother's couch at the time. And my mother actually called me the same day I was calling her to say, I think I need help. And the suggestion was that I move to Las Cruces, New Mexico, where I could engage in my recovery and my treatment. Unfortunately, the state of Maryland was not a big fan of letting me leave the area. And so I had to fly back and plead guilty and accept a waiving of my probation in Maryland so that I could actually engage with treatment and recovery here. So I actually did end up with a criminal record solely so that I could actually engage with my mental health treatment.
Now, That's a lot to go through already. I mean, moving to Las Cruces and Doñana County, what was the experience like you're finally in treatment, and when did you start to feel like, hey, okay, I can keep going, I can handle this?
It took me about a year or so to put my brain back together, as I like to call it. Moving to Las Cruces was a bit of a culture shock. You know, I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., grew up there, lived there for 35 years. So moving to a very different kind of community and culture was difficult at first. But also, this is a part where, again, to say the strange gift of my second wife, by having to strip away every aspect of my life and start over from scratch, I was actually able to put it together in a more healthy way. So we took a hard look at my 20-year career and noticed that no time during the course of that career did I actually ever successfully work a full year. I always had to take emergency medical leave for whatever reason for about a month at a time. And we now know that that was me trying to manage my condition quietly. So now I was able to structure my life in a way that is actually holistic and healthy, but also allowing me to pursue more life-affirming and more, I love the work I do now way more than I ever did IT. So, and a lot of that came from the fact that that same culture shift. Las Cruces is a really small town. Yeah. And when I started doing community work, I would be talking with people who would say they were having issues with their provider. And I would say, oh, I know that guy. I go to church with that guy. And do you mind if I talk to him on your behalf? And it started allowing me to build this relationship with providers and with the community that actually really fed into the work that all of the work I do today is based off of that, and the fact that one day I was invited to share my story.
Now let's talk about the work you're doing right mm-hmm. now. Could you share with our audience what NAMI does, and is there any specific focus here in Doñana County?
Sure. NAMI's focus, NAMI of course is an education, advocacy, and support nonprofit. Is the largest grassroots nonprofit for mental health in our country. And we focus on a wide variety of issues. So we do legislative advocacy, we do education for family members and peers and providers, and then we also run support programs. To that end, in Doñana County, we actually have education programs for family members and peers. And peers, by the way, is what we call persons with direct lived experience with mental health conditions within our organization. So we have family and peer education programs. We also have family and peer support groups. And at the legislative level, we work with the county and the state on several different jail diversion programs like the Stepping Up Initiative and Assisted Outpatient Treatment.
I want to talk about the Stepping Up Initiative. I know that there is a lot of some movement on this, and to really help people avoid detention if that's possible. Could you explain a little bit more about that and about the Stepping Up Initiative and what the goal is?
Well, one of the unfortunate realities of our country is that our nation's prisons are our largest mental health facilities. At conservative estimates are anywhere between 30 to 60% of the populations of any given detention center are people living with mental health conditions. And the crucial thing is when you talk to the wardens, the corrections officers, and the law enforcement agencies that actually put these folks there, they feel their hands are tied. They don't feel that's where these people belong, but they have no other place to put them. So a lot of the work that we do around the Stepping Up Initiative, which is a national initiative, actually, it's from the National Association of Counties for Jail Diversion, is to focus on areas in the criminal justice system where people traditionally ended up going to jail or in hospitalization in a secure facility, and try and find ways to engage them with treatment that would reduce the risk of them ending up in those situations in the first place. As I like to tell people, mental health is only a criminal justice issue when we have failed them in every possible way. I mean, mental health, it's a healthcare issue. So we need to treat it as such. Imagine, you know, somebody going to jail because they had a heart attack. That, you know, that's essentially what we're doing at this point. When somebody's condition goes into a crisis state, we lock them up into jail instead of giving them the treatment to actually get them healthy again.
Now, so far, I mean, this program's been underway in Doña County for about a year, is that correct?
Yes.
And where do you think it's going? Do you have high hopes for this program, or do you have some concerns?
I love the Stepping Up Initiative. One of the great things about the Stepping Up Initiative that we did was that we brought everyone to the table who has an interest or a hand in mental health. So we had behavioral health care providers, first responders, law enforcement, long-term treatment facilities. NAMI was there as advocates, but we also had social workers and all sorts of things. And that program has already seen some massive benefits almost instantaneously. One of our first meetings, we actually had our local community behavioral health provider, La Clinica de Familia, was talking to the detention center, and they were talking about how sometimes folks get lost in the process when they leave the detention center and are returned into the community. So they structured an agreement to bring La Clinica into the detention center and have their intake appointment at the detention center.
So everything's just kind of more in sync, and it's a lot easier. There's a lot less bureaucratic things to where people are waiting to get services. Is that something
they get a warm handoff?
So you have a good feeling about this.
I feel good about that.
I want to also talk with you about peer support.
Okay.
Specifically assistant outpatient treatment. Explain to us what exactly that is and what the goal of that is.
So assisted outpatient treatment is a civil outpatient commitment. So it is a civil court order to get an individual into outpatient treatment services. It is a crucial tool in the jail diversion process, because we take the people with the most need, the people who have struggled with their conditions the most, they've interfaced with law enforcement, they've been in detention, they've been hospitalized multiple times, and we really wrap them in a warm umbrella of just services. So, and that services are then ordered by the court. So the court holds the client accountable, but also holds the provider accountable. And it's a very intensive monitoring of this so that nobody slips between the cracks. It's a very intensive process. And we're doing it in partnership with from grants from SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, which is the federal agency that oversees mental health in the United States. And as part of SAMHSA's model, they really believe strongly in peer support. And peer support is an evidence-based practice where persons with lived experience, persons like myself, professionals with mental health conditions who have engaged with their recovery and treatment, work with clients from the perspective less of a dictatorial top-down, we know what you need better, and more of a, hey, this is what worked for me, this is what this, you know, let's work on this together.
And so it's essentially help, you know, being there for your peers. Somebody that's been there before is helping you out. Do you have any concerns about this program right now and where it's going?
Unfortunately, yes. In our community, we've had really strong support for peer support. Unfortunately, though, we've had two clients in the assisted outpatient treatment program who've requested their attorney file motions to have their peer support specialist in the hearing with them when they are assigned the treatment. And in both of those instances, the motion has been denied. And while we continue to work with the client outside of the courtroom, a vital aspect of peer support is providing that comfort and support in stressful situations, like a courtroom. And that's why the forensic peer support specialist that we have on the assisted outpatient treatment program has a history, has familiarity with criminal justice, so that they can actually work with the individual and make sure that their rights are respected, make sure that they're comfortable with what's going on, they don't feel pressured or coerced in any way. This was a crucial aspect for NAMI's support for the assisted outpatient treatment program in Doña County, and the fact that it's not happening has been a disappointment to our organization.
We're out of time, but I just want to ask you one more question, a quick answer. Were you given a reason about why peer support was not allowed in that process?
Unfortunately, no. Nobody has explained to us why they won't let the peer support specialist be in the courtroom.
Micah, I want to thank you so much for sharing so much with us. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.